So, if anyone has a question, please, you can either write it down or ask in person, yes. Well, but how to get in touch with that, you know, is the real, because sometimes people don't, you know, they get lost in just the momentum of their habits, and so like you can see now an attempt in people to realize their true calling and creativity. These words now are not just ideals, but we're now trying to recognize the reality of it. Because from my perspective, just seeing how the failure of Western civilization, for example, where the hope and the based on ideals of how things should be, and how we've really made so many errors and mistakes and the problems that we face now seemingly insolvable problems just on the level of population ecology that based on the fact that we have operated from ideas that we project onto life, and yet they say with meditation you're learning to get in touch with the natural laws, with the way things are, and this is in Buddhist terminology we call Dhamma, and I don't think we realize we could do that. We've tried to make up laws and create all kinds of ideas based on how things should be if everything was perfect, but the flow of life is in itself something where perfection as an ideal is only a very momentary experience. And life is a flux of change, is that forever changing, and so it never stays in its ideal state. And so what is it all about? I still don't know. You know what happens after it's all over? but I do. But I do see that, and then I've been invited to this conference in the States where they're talking about the state of the world, and there's also wanting to make some kind of ethical statement from the perspective of religion, and it's interesting to see just how to formulate an ethical statement of responsibility based on just the assumptions of different religions make it very fraught issue because of just the different religious approach, conventional approaches. You have the theistic religions like Christianity. And then you have non-theistic religion like Buddhism, and to make a statement on the level of convention that would cover both is going to be a really interesting experiment. Yes? That is all I can say is I don't know. And that is very important. I'm not, you know, for you to realize that you don't know, to know that you don't know, because you can have various views, you know, that people will say, you know, they go to heaven or hell, or they just disappear into thin air, or they get reborn or something, and I'm not, and one might prefer any of these particular speculations, but in terms of direct knowledge now, you know, in terms of your own, or say my own experience now about death of the body, I don't know, because I haven't died yet. And I know that life consciousness is like this. So this is what we're pointing to be with the way it is, and also to recognize, to be able to know that you don't know is wisdom, rather than to attach to various ideas out of just because, you know, just and hold to ideas about what happens when you die. But the thing with meditation is when you're realizing more and more by letting go of the conditioning of your mind, that pure state is a timeless, you know, it's timeless. So that you're actually realizing deathless, timeless reality through letting go of the conditions. And so in terms of your own experience in this life, while your body's still alive and that you're realizing in a very direct, through direct knowledge, the deathless, timeless reality, ultimate reality. But it's not something you can grasp, but it's a realization through non-attachment rather than trying to find it as an object. So when you realize that, then this whole sense of somebody died doesn't have the same power as it does when you're still operating from the conditioned cultural view of birth and death and personality and my father and me and heaven and hell and rebirth and all the rest. Then you get tangled up in all the ideas, the logic and the illogic of it, or the doubts or the anxieties or the fascination for more this, because the Buddha was pointing to the Dhamma, deathless, realizing deathlessness rather than, and to do that, then death has to be investigated, the ending of something. In terms of your own experience, like with your father, that what you're left with is the memory. Because now the memory of your father is that he's dead. Say, where before that, your father, even if he was really sick or whatever, he was still alive. And life, you can understand life because you're alive. You know, you can understand pain and hunger and loneliness and despair and all that, all the human experiences. But death of the body, since you haven't experienced, you don't know. And so you have a memory of your father now, and the word death is connected to that memory. My father is dead. So that gives up, you know now that you'll never be able to see him or relate to him in the way that when he was alive. But also to recognize that is a way to it's not depressing, but it's more like you're understanding the way things are. And then Then in the Buddhism, what we do is we try to use the memory, especially like of our parents, dead parents, for doing good works in the world. It's a way of honoring them. So that we, you know, to do something good, generous and kind, in memory of your father, is because even though he's now dead, yet we still love. We still feel, when the memory comes up, we still feel the same love. And so then using that memory as a kind of something that propels you to do good things is a way of honoring that your father or mother. And so that I found a very skillful practice. In Thailand and Sri Lanka, they do that a lot. It's very much a part of their culture. And I try to encourage here in England people, because we don't know what to do when somebody dies. You know, go and put flowers on their grave or something. About the most, you know, people can do. And this way, it's also taking the what might be a memory that leaves you sad or sense of loss. By doing something good with and using that memory to initiate something good in your life also brings you joy. So you begin to feel a joyfulness connected with your father's memory rather than just the sense of loss and sadness. So psychologically, it will bring you will change just that from being what could be depressing or just a sense of grief or loss to one of joy. And people like to, you know, we plant trees, and people like to plant trees in memory of their departed relatives, offering food to the monks and nuns. And or doing something else, you know, helping the poor or whatever, just some selfless act using that as a way of honoring. But to know that you don't know is, we feel that's a waste of time, don't we? We want to know everything. In terms of direct knowledge, direct knowing, there's this kind of knowing about things that you acquire from books, from other people, you know, that you acquired knowledge. But this in Buddhism is this direct knowing in the present, intuitive direct knowing, and so it's a. And it's not highly developed in the Western mind yet. Our minds are very much more on the acquired knowledge. The computers, I mean, we've taken this kind of knowledge to, you know, to a really high level now in this time. But it's not liberating kind of knowledge, is it? It's just confusing in the long run. The more you know, the more confused you get. Where this kind of knowing takes you, you know, is where you're knowing the origin and cessation of things, and that you're knowing the presence and absence, and you're knowing the way it is, and all this leads to a sense of peace and coolness, dispassion, emptiness, and rather than of confusion because there's no end to the kind of knowledge that you can learn about. You know, this is the information age, isn't it? They've increased our, you know, there's so much knowledge and so things to know about that it's time to learn not to know things. Yes? Right, Right. It's that's a good point, because when I talk about acceptance, people oftentimes think of it as a kind of resignation to mediocrity and misery, and because that's how we do see it as you've got to accept life and the way it is. Sounds like you've just got to put up with the mediocrity and the misery of it, which is a kind of fatalistic resignation based on negativity, not on understanding. But this acceptance is to really know something, you have to accept it. To know yourself, to really know yourself, you have to accept yourself. And all the bad things and unpleasant things about you have to accept those too. Which doesn't mean that you're approving or you like or you're justifying weaknesses and bad habits. But the only way you can understand yourself is by accepting yourself or somebody else. You know, you accept somebody else and the way they are, with their good points and bad points. Means then you can get to know them and understand them. But how many times have we failed in understanding somebody because we can't accept the bad side of them? We're always trying to change them. We're trying to we accept you only when you the way I like you, and that kind of thing. And this acceptance is very difficult for people, because we come from how things should be, and how, you know, from ideas about things, and from our own projections about people, what they are and what they should be. So this acceptance is like an understanding, is getting into that state of where you're not caught in just reacting and criticizing or attachment to somebody, but where you can begin to understand them, and yourself included, because when we understand ourselves, we tend to understand others, and vice versa. And like evil, I went to this, I was invited to the Gandhi Foundation a month ago, and in London, and they had the High Commissioner, Indian High Commissioner was there, and they presenting a bust of Mahatma Gandhi to, it was in Kingsley Hall in Bow, where Mahatma Gandhi came, when he came to England in 1931, he gave a talk in this hall, and it's still there, and they've got a kind of a Gandhi memorial, and he especially appealed to the working class at that time, 1931, because he understood the problems of of the people who are underneath the system, who are exploited by the system. So anyway, they had this. We had to give a kind of little say something about our respect or our knowledge of Mahatma Gandhi. And it was Mahatma Gandhi that inspired me actually to become a monk. And this was I remember I was in the university about 1960, in Berkeley, and I was in this program it was called South Asian Area Studies Programs. It was a kind of cultural program on India and Sri Lanka and South Asian culture. And during this time, I had a seminar with a woman Dr. Joan Bondaron, who had been working with Gandhi in the 30s or 40s, and she's a very kind of strong Gandhian figure and had written a book on Gandhi. So it was that time that, and the thing that she emphasized, or that Gandhi emphasized, was this non-resistance to evil. I was talking about this at the Gandhi Foundation. Because culturally, I was programmed to resist evil as a Christian. I was brought up as a Christian. So the idea was you resist evil at all costs. And so I was, you know, this was a big thing in my how I related to life was there's a lot of resistance to things that I in my life, and a lot of fear because of that. And so this really triggered off something inside me. Non-resistance to evil both terrified me at first. I remember feeling it shuddering when I heard it, because it was a kind of going against this very strong commandment that you've got to resist. And then it also fascinated me. And then studying and reading the works of Gandhi and contemplating them more and more, I began to get more of a feeling, rather, you know, on the level of intuition of what that really implied. And then in meditation, you know, since I've been a monk for 30 years now, in meditation, you're seeing at work that when you're resisting evil in your mind, you're giving evil enormous power. So by the very resistance and aversion and hatred and that towards evil forces or the dark forces is actually empowering them. Then the only way to not let evil have power is through non-resistance to it, which means that you accept it. It doesn't mean you like it or you approve, but you don't make a problem about it. You know it. You study it. You feel it. You know, like anger and hatred and jealousy and all these kind of emotions. You get to understand them so well that they have no power over you anymore. So you're no longer in this habitual resistance. But you, when these conditions arise, affect your consciousness, then you're. You know what they are, and you know them so well. They don't have any power to hold you. So it's through that understanding and acceptance. So, like the dark side of existence, belongs. It's part of our experience. You know, it's not that it shouldn't be here, or that there's something wrong with the universe, that this evil force exists, and that we've got to get rid of it. It's that very force needs to be understood, and this is where wisdom is you know, what is the practice of wisdom, is in understanding, not in denial or resistance. Well, that's why in yourself, you know, you start with yourself, and all the kind of anger and nastiness and selfishness and that you feel in your heart, that you've always hated yourself for, you begin to accept that more and more. Then from that acceptance and non-resistance, it loses its power. It becomes powerless. So then, in the suttas, in the scriptures, the Pali scriptures, you know, they'll have, after the Buddha's been enlightened, how many years? And Mara's the evil one in the scriptures. So Mara comes along and decides, I'm gonna see if this Buddha is really enlightened or not. And so Mara comes and tries to tempt the Buddha. And the Buddha says, I know you, Mara. So he does. He doesn't say, get out of here, you dirty so-and-so. He says, I know you. That's this kind of knowing, understanding. And I see it in myself, like you get, you know, if all these years, you know, various Maras will come in. You know, they'll try to convince me of something, and I just kept trusting that. I know you, Mara. They can really be, you know, because they're playing on your emotions, and all these kind of high power things in the human consciousness, emotional things are, you know, really quite overwhelming. And this is where this intuitive wisdom is your refuge. Is I know you. And then, just by that alone, the power is not, you're not empowering that force anymore in your life. But how are we ever going to get rid of evil and wipe it out in the universe? So obviously it's something we have to understand. We learn from it. Mm-hmm. Well, it's like a Buddhism in general is they call it non-dualism. And the Theravada, they're emphasizing the deathless as the realization of the deathless as enlightenment. So then the dualism is seen in terms of experience, but you're not attaching to either side, to either extreme. That was the middle way. So in that state of awareness and mindfulness and wisdom, then you can you begin to know the good and the bad for what they are, and then your life is, say, in terms of action and speech, is based on doing good and refraining from doing bad. So in terms of active dynamic experience, we do good and we refrain from doing bad, but we know good and bad are impermanent and not self, right? So that we are not attaching to the good either. Even though we do good, we're not identifying or attaching to it. And then the evil is we're not hating it and we're not acting on it, but we're recognizing it as a condition that has arisen and ceases. So this is where the wisdom, the punya, is developed. And then, let's see, non-dualism, dualism, monism. I think you, like Theravada, we put in the non-dual category.
Understanding evil and knowing how it is, and you use the Gandhi example, like Gandhi's like passive resistance, did a lot of good and helped get the British out of India.
Yeah.
But for example, in the Second World War, the Allies resisted it, and if they merely stood back and understood it was evil and done nothing, then Hitler would have overrun the world probably, and then like the world might have been a lot worse a place, a lot more of an evil place. So how would you say, what should people do to people that have to deal with the evil? You know, the people that really have to face the evil, soldiers, police people, what would you say to them?
Well, this is like at that, all you can say is that, like in at the time of the Second World War, nobody was prepared for passive resistance. It wouldn't have been possible because and so we don't know what would have happened. But we can see that by resisting the way we did, a lot of people got killed and a lot of destruction, but it did, you know, we did get rid of Hitler. But we haven't really solved the problem, and so it kind of carries on in many other ways. Like we can see now, just the way that we tend to deal, you know, with you know, just conflict. There's not much wisdom in it, in anything, in handling conflicts on the international scale. And in terms of people having to deal with, I mean, there's more awareness now around this, and like you can see, like the United States, for example, was ever since because they were so humiliated after Vietnam, they really don't want to get involved in anybody's war. really. You can see every time that somebody says the United States should come in and help, and they always say we don't want to do that because they lost confidence in their ability to just because they're so strong to just smash up the other side and win through just power, because you know, like the Vietnam War was a kind of the amazing example of the most powerful country in the world against probably the weakest. North Vietnam couldn't get much weaker than that, and then the United States, you couldn't get more powerful than that, and yet they lost because of the not because of they could have, you know, some kind of Pyrrhic victory, you know, if they just dropped atomic bombs all over Vietnam and completely wiped it out. they couldn't do that. And, you know, they morally, that was going beyond what was allowable. I mean, almost anything is allowable now morally except that. Thank goodness for that. But so they had to take a humiliating defeat. But it also left the United States with a much more careful about its involvements. And also there's an awareness now around the effect of war on men who have fought in wars and survived them. There's a lot of literature coming out now about just the traumas that, like when you're sending your young men off to fight, and then, you know, they're about 18, 19 years old and they come back. They're usually so traumatized by what they've experienced that they're no longer functional. So and the Vietnam, like the Vietnam War was one that really brought that into the minds of people, especially in the States, where they have this whole generation of men now whose lives have been destroyed by the trauma of that war. And so you realize you can't just, you know, exploit and misuse and let a government just kind of run you around. There's a much more a sense of individual rights, and also in Vietnam it became acceptable to be pacifists and refuse. Where before that, I remember in the Second World War that anyone who didn't get in there and fight was considered a traitor. I mean, it's a change from that, where it's just total rejection of someone who didn't go along with the government to someone who's taking moral responsibility on themselves as being a respectable act. Now we see in Chechnya, you know, the kind of hopelessness of of a determined group to fight against a more, much more powerful force, and not be, and the more powerful force not being able to really get their way. And so the time now is one where, say, there's more movement in this direct Gandhian type of awareness, hopefully. I hope. And of course, I'm in a position where I see these things more, you know, but I'm in a very special position, being a Buddhist monk. So because I meet people that are awakening, and that, where, say, most of the people, I don't know what they're like. Yes? Well, I like the Dalai Lama, he did say it was Mahatma Gandhi that inspired him, and he's been encouraging a passive resistance amongst the Tibetans, especially Tibetan monks. But and in some ways, he's even said he's failed in terms of getting, in rectifying the problem in Tibet itself. It seems even more hopeless than ever. But in terms of being an example of doing the right thing, he's been incredibly successful, the Dalai Lama. So he, maybe, I don't know if Tibet will ever be saved or not, but in terms of what he's done, I think that's more important than saving Tibet. Because he is highly regarded. He's very famous now and very glamorous figure. But he's also very pure-hearted. I mean, he's a living example of what he's preaching and how he's living. And I think that's more important than Tibet. That's just my particular view. Because even if you get back to Tibet and you're still out of fighting for it and killing off the Chinese and all that, then is Tibet going to be any better place? I really doubt it. You know, I just see it, just that this human ignorance, as long as it's not addressed, it's just, you know, goes on and on and on and on. And you, even when you've got, like here in Britain, you've got, you know, you've got a nice country to live in and all kinds of, you know, rights and privileges and all that, and yet people still are so, you know, miserable and complaining and selfish. I mean, so it's, you know, it's all right, but even when even if you've got, like here in Britain, for example, I've been here 20 years, and I was a Buddhist monk and American and all that, you feel perfectly, you know, never any problems about, you know, never with religion or with rights or anything like that. And I have no complaints against this country. You know, I feel I've been treated extremely well. And have opportunities, nice places to live in, and all the best that life can offer. And I'm content with it. But yet, even amongst the monks and nuns here, they're not content with it. And we want something more. What are you going to do? And he goes, even if you got the best, you know, when you've got everything as it, you know, as well as you can in terms of what is necessary, how many people are really can recognize that? So, not that I wouldn't want, I mean, I'd be very happy if Tibet, if the Chinese, you know, said, well, look, you know, we're sorry about all that, and we'd like to give Tibet back to the Dalai Lama, and I encourage all the Tibetans to go, and if the Tibetans think the Chinese are in the way, then we'll ask them all to return to China, and we're terribly sorry, and we'll even pay some money for all the mess we've made, and doing all the best, you know, if the Chinese suddenly turned around and did all the proper things, all the generous, kind, magnanimous gestures to Tibet, and the Tibetans returned, you know, what would they do? I don't know. If they didn't have it right inside themselves, you know, they'd still, there'd be other problems endlessly arising. So in terms of the Dalai Lama's expression, I see him as a success story, because he has captured the attention of the world, and he has exemplified non-attachment and non-aversion as a through his own presence. I've never heard him, I've met him many times, I've never heard him say anything hateful about the Chinese, or say that we should, you know, do something bad to the Chinese, or revengeful, anything like that. And he definitely loves the Chinese as much as the Tibetans. I mean, his love is embracing rather than selective or nationalistic. And that's with Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, who felt loved the British as much as he loved the Indians. You know, he wasn't an Indian nationalist per se, but he also wanted the British to do the right thing because of his love for the British. So, I mean, this is a mind of one human entity, isn't it, that embraces everything. So you can see it's possible. We have living proof of it in our, you know, Mahatma Gandhi, famous people that Dalai Lama. But how many people you don't even know are doing that, can do that? Probably a lot, you know, many more than you would think. And we can do it. It's like, we should try to do it anyway. Any more questions or? So I'll close this afternoon, and safe journey back home. Next Sunday, same time, same place.